And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Alec comes in here from the Bridge Builders group. I know that group is very glad she got sober, January 11th, 2011. And we're going to hear all about it. Everybody give her a real warm round of applause.
Hi, everybody. My name is Alec, and I'm an alcoholic. And as he said, my sobriety date is January 11th, 2011. My home group is the Bridge Builders here at NABA, weekdays at 11 a.m. and on the weekends at 11:30. I have a sponsor. She's here today, and I sponsor women. And I'm so grateful to be a part of this fellowship. So I was born in Atlanta, and alcoholism runs on both sides of my family as far as the eye can see, so it's probably just a matter of time. I've been compulsively making artwork since I was about 4 years old, and that sort of gave me a little imaginary world to live in when I needed to. It was in my home. It was either very, very quiet, like the kind of silence that eats away at you from the inside, or it was pretty loud and angry. I say that it was tough to grow up, as if it's like easy to grow up now or something. But anyway, it wasn't very easy. My apartment burned down when I was 9 years old, although that was a really, like, bad thing that happened, I really liked the attention that I got from it. Like, I didn't realize, like, how many people, cared about me and stuff until something awful like that happened. And I also realized then that, I could use these, woe is me experiences to manipulate you to get what I want from you, or to get you to feel sorry for me or look at me in a different way. I definitely started manipulating at a young age. Anyway, when I turned 14 years old, some pretty significant events happened in my life in a very short period of time. Within 2 weeks, puberty happened. I turned 14. My parents told me they were getting a divorce, and before I had a hit of a cigarette or a sip of alcohol, my sister gave me LSD on my 14th birthday. I basically went from having a fairly normal, I guess, relationship to my body, my family, and reality to, like, not having any idea what the hell was going on. Not long after that, I had my first drink, and I liked it a lot more than the LSD. I felt like I had more control, you know? And I sort of hit the ground running from there. I drank at every opportunity, which at 14 is not very often. But I was a blackout drinker pretty much from the get-go. I thought the goal of drinking was to check out of reality the same way that I did with my artwork. Like I said, I learned at an early age that the world is a cruel, mean place to be. So. You better not be in it as often as possible. In high school, my friends, I remember, like, my groups of friends changing, and I think they changed with my drinking. School's always been kind of easy for me. I never really applied myself very much. I guess I won't say that it was easy. It was just kind of, like, annoying, like it was like one of those things that you just kind of had to do. But any time there was a party, I was there. People knew that if they didn't want to go to class, my house was a place to come. And I should say probably that when my parents got divorced, I ended up living with my father, who has very severe chronic depression. And so I was able to do whatever I wanted whenever I wanted. He was also, he had no problem like signing me excuses from school and stuff like that. As long as I came home with decent grades, he didn't care what I was doing. And so my house was pretty chaotic. My sister was, like, raving at the time, and she would bring home people. I mean, we had, like, kids that got kicked out of their house would live at our house and stuff like that. It was just a pretty open door policy at home. So I guess moving forward, when I got into college, that's when I started using other substances that I'm not really going to talk about. I basically use them simply to drink more and more often and, you know, greater amounts. I fell in love with Jameson whiskey, and I had a lot of my friends convinced that, like, they were like, you should just get Jameson tattooed somewhere on your body because you're basically, like, you know. So, yeah, while I was in college, it was a ton of, it was, I was one of those people that made sure that I looked really good on paper. I made sure that my grandma, you know, would have no reason to think that there was anything going on or anything wrong. And, you know, since my dad didn't really, I don't think that he even really knew, you know, like he was just kind of checked out at the time. Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, after college, I'm just going to sort of breeze through this. I didn't really form any kind of identity except that, like, I was the party chick. I could keep up with the football players. Like, I just wanted to know where the party was. And once again, like, as far from reality as I can possibly be, as long as I can just maintain this shaky, you know, looking good on paper thing for you. After I graduated from college, I was stuck in this cycle where I worked at a sports bar, and across the street from the sports bar, oh, I also didn't have a car, okay? So, like, in college, I would often just, like, pack a bag full of crap that nobody really needs, like big goofy glasses and like ridiculous clothes and stuff. And I would just go off into the night on MARTA and have no idea where I was going to end up, or like, you know, I would like go to a concert or something and just sort of like end up running into people that I knew, and I would sleep over here or over there or whatever. Just totally, like, I felt like I was pretty fearless. Like, you know, I just kind of went with the flow. Wherever the party was going, that's where I was going to be. But somehow maintained, you know, good grades through college. So yeah, I graduated from college and I was working at a sports bar, and directly across the street was a liquor store, and it was two blocks from my house. And so it was extremely convenient, and I got stuck in this cycle where I would walk from home to the sports bar, work, get my tip money, go to the liquor store, pick up a bottle, go back home, call some friends if they wanted to come. Whether or not they came, it didn't really matter because I was going to be getting wasted. And that's just how it went for a really long time, you know? And I ended up basically thinking, you know, that Atlanta was my problem, and I've got to get the hell away from all these people. And I was dating a guy at the time who, I knew a girl in college, and her boyfriend owned a property in California. He's from California, and he was starting a music business in Atlanta. Basically, things in California, his dogs had puppies or something, and he needed somebody to go out to California and take care of his puppies. And I thought this was like a golden opportunity for me to get the hell out of Atlanta and out of my little cycle, you know? I thought this move to California was going to cure me. He basically said, you know, I'll give you free food and free rent to take care of 9 pit bulls in California. And you'll be able to pursue your artwork full time, which was like the golden ticket for me, you know, like you just dangle, like I can make artwork full time. What? I'm thinking that taking care of these dogs is like a piece of cake, right? So, and the guy ends up saying also that like my boyfriend of 3.5 months can come with me. And I'm like, oh yay. Like 3.5 month boyfriend, let's move across the country together. So, So we did. We just packed up all of our stuff into the car, and I told my family about it, and I don't know what they were thinking. None of them really said, you know, I just stressed the whole, like, pursue my artwork, like, this is my dreams coming true, you know? The thing that I learned from that is that if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I ended up going out there to California. We found out that we were living with a junkie in California and that there was a very large horticulture operation in the garage. And which my boyfriend was totally pleased about. Like, he loved it. And so as soon as we showed up there, you know, my landlord and his girlfriend were back in Atlanta. And as soon as we showed up there, we learned very quickly that these dogs they were sick, right? They had this thing called coccidiosis, and they, explosive messes all over the place, all the time. And this landlord of mine, you know, made sure that I knew, like, don't use your money, like, I'll pay you, you know, like, nothing, I mean, you know, there were no transfers or anything was going on, and my job is to take care of the dogs, so I'm going to take care of the dogs, you know, and I had a little bit of money saved up, and so had my boyfriend at the time. So, of course, we, you know, after a long night of staying up and cleaning up after 6 pooping puppies and, like, it was bad, we took them all to the vet, took care of it, you know, and then the guy's on the phone saying, you know, I'll be there next week to pay you. And as I learned that this wasn't panning out the way that I had thought it would or the way that he was telling me it would, once again, I picked up the bottle and my drinking got really out of control really quickly, along with some of the ease and comfort that came from the garage. Yeah, I was totally out of it. I was experiencing some, I couldn't eat and stuff. I was fainting sometimes too. And my roommate, I mean, the junkie roommate that we had was in real bad shape. Like, he like hardly ever left his room. And he had like a piss bucket. It was bad. So we did our job. We never really got paid. We got a little pittance here and there, and my best friend, you know, the girl whose boyfriend was our landlord, she made sure that I knew that I was her little servant person. I don't know who she thought she was talking to, but it was amazing how our relationship changed from when I was in Atlanta to when I was in California. And this just sort of, you know, reassured the fact that I can't trust anybody. You know, it's a cruel, mean world. The only thing you can count on is yourself and stuff like that. So we basically stayed there long enough to take care of the puppies and sell them to make some of our money back. And when we found out that my landlord was coming back in town, we had already moved all of our stuff into a storage unit, and we left to Portland. And we got a lot of very threatening phone calls. Another thing that I found out while I was living there was that this guy was wanted from the Mexican mafia for like $50,000. So I was like afraid for my life. It was bad. So a little unmanageable, just a little bit. So we went up to Portland, turned our phones off, got a lot of threats, and I remember saying something to the, you know, like something to the amount of, or I don't, whatever word I was looking for, of, you know, like if you call me again, I will not hesitate to call the police and tell them everything that I know about you. And that got them off of our backs for quite some time. We moved up to Eugene, Oregon, and stayed with some friends of my boyfriend in their house there. I didn't have a job. I was very afraid of being poor, and I made it a full-time job to find a job. And I got an interview at this retirement home to wait tables at a retirement home. And so it was the night before the interview, right? And it was also the Ducks versus Alabama game. And if you guys, you know, in Eugene is the University of Oregon, the Ducks. So it was a big game day, right? So it's like everybody is getting wasted with me and I'm celebrating my interview tomorrow morning, you know. So we go out and I had every intention of just getting totally obliterated. And that's exactly what I did. And we got back home and, my boyfriend, you know, I had the same old conversation with him about, how I was super stressed about money and like really worried. And he ended up saying something to me that, had I not been drunk, I probably wouldn't have misinterpreted it. my degree is in art. I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in sculpture. And he basically said, well, Alec, I mean, you know, if you wanted to make money, you would have gotten a degree in business. And I was like, oh, hell no, he didn't, you know? And I just seriously, like, and I mean, he was just saying, like, of course, like, if somebody wanted to make a lot of money, they would have gotten a degree in finance or business or whatever. Like, the same thing has come out of my mouth before. But because I was wasted and because I had been through all of this, you know, hell on earth and was so far away from anybody I've ever known in my entire life, except for him, I just took pretty much every single vulnerability that guy had, and I just sliced and diced, in a really awful way. And I had tried, you know, back in Atlanta, I had tried unsuccessfully getting sober many times, in all kinds of ways. And for whatever reason, the following morning after that, extravaganza, the only thought that was in my head was I need AA. I woke up and I knew that sorry wasn't going to cut it. I woke up and I knew that there wasn't any explaining that I could do. And this was seriously like the only connection that I had of any kind of real human support or emotion, and I just ripped him apart. Anyway, I went to my first AA meeting that day before my interview, and there was a woman who inflicted her sponsorship on me. And I'm so grateful for that. I went to another meeting after my interview. I probably reeked of alcohol after an interview, but I ended up getting the job, which was cool. So I started calling this woman every day. I just knew that I didn't know how to do anything, and I was such a hollow shell of a person. I didn't recognize myself. I couldn't tell the truth to my parents. I couldn't tell the truth to anybody that I cared about, you know, back home. And I didn't even know really who I cared about or who cared about me. Nobody was to be found. Nobody called when I moved to California to see how I was doing, you know. I got a sponsor immediately, started working the steps with her. And when I got to step two, she made it very clear to me that she was a Bible-believing follower of Jesus Christ, and that if I didn't agree with her, she was going to pray for God to reveal the truth to me. And I have a lot of past issues with, you know, Christianity, you know. Just as a general, I don't mean to, like, my grandparents are Southern Baptist missionaries who were very strict and, you know, dogmatic and all this and all that. I was so confused. Like, I was so afraid because, like, this was my sponsor, you know, and I just wanted to, like, freely discuss with her what my concept of a higher power was. And she made it very clear that, like, that wasn't the truth according to her. And I was so terrified because I didn't think that I could tell her what I needed to tell her to finish the steps. But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know if my baggage was keeping me from being helped from this woman, you know? So I ended up I just talked to a bunch of women about it. I kept going to meetings. Like, I was at meetings all the time. Like, that was my life. I didn't have a car, so I just walked to meetings. It didn't matter how far away it was. I just started walking and kept walking until I got to a meeting. And I ended up getting a suggestion to work with another woman. And I've come to find that you can rely on the suggestions that members of Alcoholics Anonymous give to you. This woman was a perfect fit for me. I could not have. It was a total godsend, this woman. And I will say that on some level, on the deepest level that I conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I have since then conceded on far more deeper levels that I'm an alcoholic. It's so funny because it's like if I was half as smart as I thought I was when I got here, I would have come up with this whole, you know, your own concept of God all by myself, but I didn't. And my sponsor had me do this little exercise that was really helpful, where she had me write down all of the characteristics that I would want out of an ideal friend, like an ideal best friend. And so I did that, and then when I came back to her, she said, that's your concept of higher power. That can be your higher power if you want. And I needed that. I needed that a lot. Because I didn't know what a friend was. You know, my idea of a friend was like somebody who had some crazy psychedelic experience with you and you just don't understand our connection, you know? So I kept moving through the steps with this woman, and this group of people that I found in Eugene were absolutely out of control. I mean, I learned what friendship, they taught me what it was like to be dependable and reliable, you know, and I was really apprehensive at first to get a home group because I didn't know that I could go somewhere on time, like, every week. I didn't know that I could show up when I needed to. But I was willing to try. I needed to get sober. And so I did. Sorry, guys. And so I did. I picked a home group. I got a service position at my home group. I was greeting. And that was awesome to get to meet, to get to meet people. One thing that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that doing things when I'm uncomfortable that force me to be a part of instead of apart from, they give me such powerful experiences like the one that I'm having right now, and I hope that each and every single one of you get to experience it. I continued to work with my sponsor through the steps, and I was so confused at 3, you know. And I was really grateful because she read to me the prayer that was in 11, the St. Francis prayer about, you know, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there's despair, I may bring hope, things like that. And she said, if you want, you know, God's will can be to bring hope and light and truth and things like that. And that also really helped me a lot because then it didn't become so confusing in particular. You know, like my brain has a way of just like making everything such a big deal when it's just really not. And so if I can just put myself in alignment with those reliable principles, they never let me down, and it's just totally blows my mind. I will say that I tried, you know, I remember when I was drinking, I wanted some kind of God. I wanted a concept of God and an experience of God, and I couldn't find it anywhere. It was one of the things where I tried hanging out with, like, the church going people or the religious kind of people. And I just didn't agree with so much of what they said that I ended up feeling basically like, God doesn't want me. Like, I'm not God material. You know what I'm saying? And it was so powerful to just, it was one of those things where after I did my third step, I remember going home, and I don't remember what was going on in my mind at the time, but I was able to feel, like, to intend to feel connected to everything, and it worked. Like I felt connected, you know, to something bigger than myself. And then I remember, like, when my alcoholic mind would go back into obsessing about whatever I was obsessing about, that I didn't feel, I could feel the difference between connected and not connected. And that was a really powerful experience for me. Kept working through the steps. I can tell you right now, there's no way in hell this alcoholic would have done a fourth step without the third step. There's just no way. Absolutely no way. I had tried getting rid of my baggage in so many different ways before, and nothing worked. And I believed that it had to work, you know, for you guys. Because you just told me to do it, and I was like, something, anything. And so I did my fourth step, just busted my butt on it. Once again, I'm walking to work and meetings every day. I was living in a house at the time with 4 people who were still using and drinking. There was a handle of vodka on the counter for a lot of that time. I would come home from meetings, and they would be like doing lines of cocaine off of the coffee table and like blowing big billows of smoke in my face. And I just ran to my room and gripped the big book with both of my hands and just read that sucker. I ended up meeting an alcoholic who lived right around the corner from me, and she was sober in the program. And, she was so nice because she, basically told me, like, you can come over anytime. And I did that, and we became really good friends. And it's incredible because since then, she's actually flown from Eugene, Oregon to come and see me in Atlanta. I never had a friend that would ever do anything. I mean, I couldn't even get friends to, like, drive to my birthday party. You know what I mean? Anyway, I just continued working through the steps. 5, I was really scared about 5. But I did it. I did it with this girl that was, you know, once again, the sponsor that that I was suggested to have was right on for me. And I ended up doing my fifth step, and it was really scary, and I didn't know if I was leaving something out or, you know, I was like super worried because I didn't want to mess up. I didn't want to drink again. And I did it, and she asked if there was anything else. She said, you know, after the hour that I took at home, that if anything came up, that I could call her immediately afterwards and you know, say something else to her. So I did that, and that hour afterwards, man, was really powerful for me, too. Just the hour of reflection and looking back on everything. I felt like I had new eyeballs, you know? Like, I felt like I was seeing everything totally differently. And I didn't understand why, and I still don't understand why, but I'm just so glad this shit works, man. For the first time in my life, you know, this I was finding relief from my alcoholism. My alcoholism just tormented me on and on for my whole entire life. Like, I never knew who I was apart from alcoholism. And for the first time ever, I'm learning who that is, and it's pretty cool. 6 and 7, I'm still learning a lot in both 6 and 7, and I didn't really understand how those things were working either. I just kept doing what my sponsor told me to do, you know? When I got to 8, you know, I had my list, and I wasn't really worried about... Sorry was kind of my mantra, you know? So, like, I wasn't really worried about saying sorry to people. Of course, I learned that that's not what it's about. It's not about saying sorry. Because sorry doesn't work if you're an alcoholic like me. You have to do something. I ended up... my mother at the time lived in Saudi Arabia, and... So I wrote a letter, like a script to write to her, and I did my amends with her over the phone. She's also one of us who got sober a long time ago. And when I made my amends to her, it was really cool. That experience was really cool. This was a woman who, for 5 years of my, like from the time I was about 14 to 19, I didn't speak with my mother. And so slowly but surely that relationship... you know, was getting better. And the crazy thing is that I recently went to visit her in Saudi Arabia. And I don't know how else to say it, but that relationship is right now, like, currently in the fourth dimension of existence. Like, it blows my mind. Like, this woman, like, I got to know my mom as an individual, as a person, and, like, I really want to know this person. And it's not... we had so much fun together. Like, it was just, it was crazy. I didn't realize that I could, and thank God for the internet. Oh my God. When I got there. Okay, so I mean, she's like a woman, like a white woman living in Saudi Arabia, right? Not so easy to do. She's also a sober alcoholic that, like, doesn't have any meetings because alcohol is, like, illegal, so why would they need any AA in Saudi Arabia? So I go and I'm, like, hanging out with my mom, and the first day that I got there, I was super worried because she's a little crazy, like, just a little bit. And I was worried because I was like, oh, God, like, this craziness is way, like, it's going to affect me way more easily than I can be a positive influence on her, you know? And so I wrote to my sponsor, and thank God she gave me, like, best advice ever. She basically said, you know, what is God trying to teach you through your mom right now? And how can you be helpful to her? Like, you don't know how it is to be her. You know, take yourself out of it and try to see where God is trying to teach you. And as soon as I could make that shift in my brain, man, the whole thing opened up to me. We talk back and forth now. Like, I just love my mom. She's freaking awesome. And I wouldn't have said this to you, like, 10 years ago. I wouldn't have said this to you. I continued, you know, through the amends. Oh, so, okay, so I got sober, 3.5 months sober in Eugene, Oregon. I was basically placed in a predicament because I could either go and live in this woman's sober house or move back home to Atlanta. Of course, those were, like, the options in my head. I had plenty more options than that, but I wasn't, you know, able to see any of them. And I ended up... freaking out a lot about it, but basically deciding to move back to Atlanta. And it's really funny because ever since I was like 12 years old, I've wanted to take a cross-country road trip with my dad. And my life circumstances just so happened to make that a perfect opportunity. So I just busted my butt. You know, I was working two jobs, walking everywhere, and like to, you know, taking the bus too, and then just going to meetings all the time. And I was able to save up enough money to rent a 10-foot truck and get my dad to fly out to Portland. And we drove in a 10-foot truck with all my stuff, like, through Yellowstone National Park, and, like, it was so cool, man. I made amends to my dad, like, going over the Kansas state line in this 10-foot truck. Yeah, it was really cool. And that was also a really powerful experience. I'm a men's man. Like, don't let the boogeyman get you, because it's, like, some really powerful stuff. You know, you think... I don't know, like, I was the kind of person, like, you could compliment me, and I couldn't accept it or say thank you, because if you really knew who I was, there's no way in hell you'd be saying that. And it's the same kind of thing, like, a same kind of mental thing with the men's. Like, I was like, oh, shit, like, I can't go see that person again. Like, they're going to, you know, like, I don't want to put myself in this vulnerable state where they have the power to just totally shut me down or whatever. And I've not had a bad experience making amends with anyone. That's just been my... I'm really grateful for that experience. So then, yeah, in 10, I started doing the... I had been doing, like, checking myself a lot just throughout the day and stuff. And I also... One of the early things that my sponsor had me do was start helping people immediately, like, start setting up chairs. Or if an alcoholic says something to you, you know, you acknowledge them and say something back to them. And just finding little ways that I could be helpful to people. People in general, alcoholics especially, you know. In 10, I started doing like the nightly written thing and inventory. And I ended up getting such awareness out of that that I didn't really, I don't know. I just didn't, and I'm super glad that in the big book it talks about how, you know, we're careful not to fall into self-pity or remorse, because that it keeps away from our usefulness to others, and then also for the positives at the end of the day also, because that helped me realize that I was still on track, you know. And 11 for me, my sponsor had me take that prayer, the St. Francis prayer, and take a stack of sticky notes and write one line of the prayer on each sticky note for every day, and then stick the sticky notes on my mirror. So the first day, my mission or my mantra for the day was to be a channel of peace. You know, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. And, you know, this whole meditation thing kind of like threw me. I was like, you know, I'm not a monk that sits on a mountain and gets, I don't know, like... I just didn't know how to do it, and I was scared of it. And it was really cool because it was kind of a meditation. Like, make me a channel of that peace. Make me a channel of that peace. Like, I could do that. It simplified things, and it gave me a purpose where I could be like, you know, like my higher powers agent, like going out in the world. And it's like, you never know, like, what the day is going to provide you with. And once again, it was sort of like, putting myself in this different realm of existence, you know, And the crazy thing is like that I had the power to do that. Like, I had no idea that it was that simple, or that it could be that simple. And so I did that every day, and God showed up in such incredible ways for me. I highly recommend that if you're struggling with your connection, that you try it, because it was really incredible for me. And then when I got to 12, it was suggested to me not to raise my hand to sponsor people, because I would be moving back to Atlanta while I was still finishing up the steps in Eugene. But as soon as I got to Atlanta, I pretty much started doing that. It blows my mind, man. Like working with other women, it just totally blows my mind. Through that, I also become so much more aware of myself and aware of the power that's in my life. I become so much more aware of the fact that everything does happen for a reason and a purpose. And I'm so grateful for that, because sometimes it's not my job to figure it out, you know? It's not my job to figure out what it is at the time. And it always reveals itself to me, always, as long as I keep coming back and keep talking to alcoholics. I will say that that first sponsor that told me she was a Bible-believing follower of Jesus Christ and that she was going to pray for God to reveal the truth to me, she gave me this CD, this Mickey Bush speaker tape. And Mickey Bush is this really funny speaker. And when I listened to his tape, I remember having, you know, when I was clinging to the big book, living in that house with the four people who were still using and drinking, I was just holding on for dear life, you know, and I didn't really get into the language, and there were certain things that were kind of in my way. And as soon as I listened to that CD, like, he just made the big book come alive for me. I was just cracking up, like, left and right. And it's one of the coolest things that he said. It's like, hey, I don't get through to well people. And I was like, yeah, me neither. So, he's this British guy, and he always gives his phone number out on his speaker tapes. And so I called him because I wanted to thank him so much for carrying the message to me. And I called him, and it was really funny because he's like, you know, how many days you got? And I was like, like 12. He's like, why you only got 12 days? You've been relapsing or something. And I was like, no, I haven't been relapsing, Mickey. Like, you got to start somewhere, you know? And he ended up sending me a text message to this guy named Todd. And Todd is like this toothless guy that was like a crackhead in South Chicago and like no teeth, and he was a cab driver, right? Got in touch with Todd. Todd was so awesome. He was like, he would pick me up for meetings and stuff. And he carried the message in a really cool way too. He's like, he had like sailor's mouth, you know what I mean? Like, and he didn't even think about it. He didn't think twice about it. He was like, you know what? God needs sailor-mouthed cab drivers too, okay? And I love that. I'm seriously, like, you know, there's a place for all of us to be useful and helpful to others and to carry the message. Todd and I kept on talking about how we were going to drive up to Washington, which is where Mickey Bush lived, and we were going to go and see him speak sometime. And it ended up not happening. You know, I was only in Eugene for 3.5 months. And so I moved back to Atlanta. Oh, and that was kind of a difficult transition. But once again, like, just throw yourself out there, man. Like throw yourself into a position where you can be a part of instead of apart from, and God will show up, I promise. At least that's how it's worked out for me every single time. I met my boyfriend in the program, and we had been together for several months, and he was going on a business trip to Las Vegas. I had never been to Las Vegas before. He asked if I wanted to come with him, and I was like, of course I want to go with you to Vegas. That sounds awesome. So I was a little nervous about that, but we ended up flying out there and finding a meeting in the basement of this Korean church in Las Vegas, and none other than Mickey Bush shows up in this Korean basement. You know, and he just raised it, oh, I'm Mickey Bush, I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding me. Right when I need some Mickey Bush in my life. Like, I just started my first experience in Vegas, and there he is. And I was able to take a picture with him and send it to Todd, who was visiting his mom in Chicago at the time. It was so cool, man. This program is like beyond any. I couldn't have asked for it. I just blows my mind. Fourth dimension of existence, right on, Bill W. Thank you for those words, because I couldn't explain it any better. I just don't even know what else to say. This is the coolest deal. This is the coolest deal in the world. And I was so worried at the beginning, you know. I was like, who am I going to hang out now that I'm sober, you know? Like, what am I going to do? And it's like, well, duh. Like, I'm going to hang out with people who ran as hard as I did. Like, I'm going to hang out with people who were just as, you know, they played just as hard, worked just as hard. And I was so grateful to come into sobriety and when life just slowed down a little bit, man. Like, life was so fast, and I was just this pinball, just bouncing and reacting to everything, and just totally unconscious and unaware that I was able to, like, play a role in my life, you know? And it's just really cool to, like, be aware of the role that I can play in my life today, and recognize that I do have choices and decisions to make, and that I have the ability now to make a difference in somebody else's life, that so that they can see through new eyes, you know, and they can experience some of this some of this awesome power that we get to have access to through these 12 steps. Anyway, I wanted to read something out of the big book and then something else that Mama T wrote. Okay, I'm coming out of The Keys of the Kingdom on page 275. It says, AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It's a way of life, and the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other, it's essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line, and we find that we are compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude, that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience the thrill of challenge and the opportunity it affords for another application of AA's techniques, and we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. I just really like that a lot, so I wanted to share it with you. And then I've got one last thing to say. Mother Teresa wrote this poem. It is not it's not AA-approved literature, but it's Alec Adelson-approved literature. It's called Anyway by Mother Teresa. It says, people are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you will spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best that you've got anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and your God. It was never between you and them anyway. That's all I have. Thank you.
I don't know if everyone got a chance to see her cowboy boots, but those boots were made for speaking. And Alex certainly earned her spurs tonight.